Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich at 5, and then Steve Cochran at 6. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is along with our 12,000 fans on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, time to talk TV. We have Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, on with us every couple of weeks just to catch up on TV. It's always great to talk with Dan. You can follow Dan on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we're here to talk about television, and let's welcome Dan to the show. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you, Nick?
Not bad. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's start off with, you know, the last time that we talked, I was not aware of the show The Ranch on Netflix. And since then, I've watched six episodes. And remind everybody what The Ranch is so they know in case they weren't listening the last time.
The Ranch is the Netflix multi-cam sitcom starring Ashton Kutcher and Danny Masterson. You've probably seen the commercials for and gone, why do I want to watch a multi-cam sitcom with Ashton Kutcher and Danny Masterson on Netflix? Except it's good because it also has Sam Elliott and Deborah Winger in it. And that's what The Ranch is.
Yeah, it's an interesting. It took me a while to, you know, you pointed this out the last time. It's a little off-putting when you've got a studio audience, you got the multicam sitcom, and they're dropping F-bombs, and they're showing their butts and stuff, and it is a little bit off-putting. And that also was the case for me when I watched Lucky Louie, on HBO. All those years ago, when Louis C.K.'s first crack at a sitcom. And it takes a little getting used to. For the most part, it wasn't a show for me that I was compelled to watch the next episode immediately. I got through six episodes. I'll probably finish watching it, but I don't feel as compelled. I will say this. The last episode that I watched, episode six, was the one that carried the most weight and had the best stuff in it. And that was the episode, Dan, where Sam Elliott, who plays, you know, the father of Danny Masterson and Ashton Kutcher and Deborah Winger plays their mother. But he is like, he's steadfast in his ways. He's, you know, he's curmudgeonly because he's Sam Elliott. He finally asks the character that Deborah Winger plays to move, but they're separated. She's living in a trailer and he's living in the ranch. And he asks her to come back. And there's a really nice scene where they're on the porch talking. And I what was going on with Ashton Kutcher's character in that and Danny Masterson's character, I found that finally the dynamic was coming together. But it took a little while for me. Now, were you with it right from the start?
I wasn't with it right from the start, but I was definitely with it by the end of the first episode. It was just a matter of figuring out the tone that they're going for, because it's an interesting mixture of very broad and sometimes a little bit grating multicam humor,
yeah,
and actual character moments from all of the actors, Ashton Kutcher included, and Danny Masterson as the series progresses. Probably not until maybe the 9th or 10th or 11th episodes do you really know. I haven't gotten to 11th. There are only 10 episodes in the first half of the season. But anyway, right, towards the end of the run, Danny Masterson also gets to do some semi-effective work. And I think that you have to have the comedy moments so that the dramatic moments can kind of slip in and slip under your skin, and you can go, okay, maybe there's something underneath these characters, and maybe that's the kind of innovative thing the show's doing.
I think
you have to sort of give yourself over to it. You have to deal with the fact that maybe the funny parts aren't the best part of the show. But I think that's an interesting thing that it's doing.
I agree with you, Dan. It's still kind of an odd thing because, you know, you're right. There are the stupid setup punchline laugh from the studio audience gags that are sprinkled throughout that aren't particularly clever and sometimes aren't particularly funny even. But then every once in a while something happens where you go, oh, okay. And so I'm with you. I'm basically echoing everything you're saying, except I don't think I like it quite as much as you do.
Which is totally fine, and I think that I think that it's a worthy show. And sort of what my goal is, as which I figure is often my goal as a critic, is just to, if at all possible, make people get over their initial misgivings, because if you see a trailer for it, it really does look obnoxious, and I can't disagree with that at all. And I think that there's a deeper show here, and I think that the show that's underneath that studio audience roaring, whatever, I think that's a show that's worth talking about and worth giving, you know, a few minutes to. If it doesn't work for some people, totally fine.
And there are some other supporting characters that show up that were fun to see. Like, it was fun to see Ethan Suplee show up in it, and Alicia Cuthbert hasn't been seen in a long time in anything regularly.
Oh, that's not true. She just had Happy Endings, of course.
Happy Endings, of course. Yeah.
And then she had the show where she played the pregnant lesbian on NBC last year that nobody watched because it was awful. And I'm not even going to pretend I remember what that show was called. I watched every episode of it. There were only six. Ellen DeGeneres produced it. It was brutally awful.
I did not see it, but of course.
It's too bad, because she's genuinely funny, and she's I think she's doing something nice here, because she's not overplaying anything. She's playing it very sort of subtle and salt of the earth, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I didn't even recognize her, because I think it's because of the kind of character that she's playing.
I think there's a lot of people who are being nicely slotted in here. In the later episodes, Barry Corbin, who's been in lots and lots of things.
Oh, wait, Barry Corbin's going to be on it?
Indeed, and he has some scenes with Sam Elliott.
Oh.
Exactly what you would think that they would be.
Okay, well, now I'm going to go home and watch it now.
You have to do it. He plays a vet who is hard of hearing. And his methodology runs afoul of how Sam Elliott likes to run his ranch. And it's just like watching Barry Corbin and Sam Elliott.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's it. I'm in now. I didn't know Barry Corbin was going to be in it. God, I love that guy. All right, well, that's cool. All right, well, so that's The Ranch. Give it a shot. It's on Netflix. Let's talk a little bit about some of this stuff. Let's talk about Game of Silence. That's an NBC show. You just mentioned NBC, but in a negative way. But how do you feel about Game of Silence? You're not very positive on this one either.
I'm not going to mention this one in a positive way either. So that's just one of those things. No, Game of Silence is the easiest way to describe it is to say that it's a lot like the movie Sleepers, the Barry Levinson movie Sleepers, only in TV form, because otherwise it's complicated. I mean, basically, it's kids who shared a childhood trauma. In Sleepers, it involves an orphanage and molesting priests and whatnot. In this case, it involves a juvenile detention facility, which also is dark and messed up in somewhat comparable ways. And then 25 years later, crimes bring them back together. Will they get the truth out? Will anyone care? Progressively less as they go along.
Mm. And now, who's behind it? Who's in it? Anybody of note?
Well, people, I mean, NBC fans will recognize that NBC has been trying to make David Lyons happen for a number of years. He was, of course, the star of the classic The Cape. So that was a thing.
Oh, my God. I totally forgot about that show, Dan.
And then he spent 2 years as one of the stars of Revolution. And so, you know, NBC keeps trying. Lorenz Tate has been in many, many, many things. So he's familiar. There are a number of people who will be familiar to some TV audiences. It's from David Hudgens, who's, I believe, a Friday Night Lights veteran, but not one of the top one or two, but you know, a veteran of the show. And it's twisty and lots of revenge and stuff. It's basically, if Secrets and Lies on ABC and Revenge on ABC could have a baby that wasn't really all that exciting, but still had some secrets and lies and also some revenge, that would be what Game of Silence would be.
Okay. All right. And now, has it aired yet?
It premiered on Tuesday after The Voice, because that's the only thing that NBC at this point has as a launching pad. So basically everything NBC has, they're giving it one episode tryouts after The Voice. They did that with Heartbeat, which was pretty awful. They did it with this, which is, it's not awful. And, you know, some people are going to like it because, I don't know, people like potboiler mysteries.
Yeah.
And this is not a great one. And so there are definitely better ones out there on television. More people should have watched Cap'n Leonard on Sundance TV, which is like a good potboiler mystery.
Which I watched and I thought was great.
Yeah, it's really good, and, you know, 6 episodes, and it's probably all on demand somewhere, and you can watch it, and maybe if people go and watch it on demand, it will convince Sundance TV to pick up a second season, which they really should do. But Game of Thrones is not that good, but on the other hand, lots of people go through a lot of popular mysteries. I do it where, you know, it doesn't matter so much if it's all that good. I like getting to the end and finding out who did what, right. And maybe some people will get sucked into that with Game of Silence. I had 9 episodes on screener. I made it through 7, and I doubt that I'll ever watch the last few.
Okay. All right, Dan, thanks. Hold on a second, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and we love to talk TV with Dan. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we'll have more with Dan after we take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. It's Vic DiGiulio. Good morning. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here. Welcome back to the show. It is a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday, yeah, for Triple Play Thursday. Right now, though, we're talking TV with Dan Feinberg. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, talk and text. Follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show, and hit us up on Facebook. Like us, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk about Dice. This is the new Andrew Dice Clay Showtime show. And I've only seen the first episode. I don't have Showtime. But they were offering up the first episode, so I did watch the first episode. Tell everybody what Dice is and how you feel about it.
It is the story of Andrew Dice Clay, a former 1980s and early 90s stand-up star. He might sound familiar.
Yeah.
Many people think of him for his persona, the Dice Man. Many people have negative connotations with that persona, but now he's just a... I guess 50-something, maybe? I'm not sure exactly how old Andrew Dice Clay is.
Yeah.
You know, guy living just on the outskirts of Las Vegas, doing shows sometimes, not necessarily starving to death, but also not as wealthy as he was back in 1989, 1990, back in his Ford Fairlane days. And, he's just going through life in the same way that, say, Larry David goes through life on Curb Your Enthusiasm, or Rob Schneider goes through life on that bad Rob Schneider show that's on Netflix that no one watches. So
that seems to be, I was just going to say, that seems to be a thing. Hasselhoff has one.
I think Hasselhoff's is more, I believe, semi-real. I think it's one of more of those hybrid-y shows.
Yeah,
where it actually has real elements.
I interviewed Hasselhoff a few weeks ago. I sat in on the morning show here. I hosted the morning show and we had Hasselhoff on. So I watched. They sent me a link and I watched a few of the episodes. It's actually a pretty funny show. Have you seen it?
I have not. I definitely have screeners somewhere, and just somehow the opportunity never came. How was the Hoff?
Well, it's called Hoff the Record. See?
I see what he did there.
Yeah. And it's on Access TV, which not everybody gets. But it's pretty funny. It's the same kind of thing. It's Hasselhoff being Hasselhoff and dealing with, you know, his reputation and, you know, his career. It's kind of going nowhere. They have actors playing his agent. They have actors playing his driver, his, you know, personal trainer, all that stuff. And it's, you know, it's hit and miss, like a lot of these shows. Not everything can be Curb Your Enthusiasm. And, but it's, you know, he's fine on it. He's doing what he normally does. The thing is, they surrounded him with really funny people. A lot of people I've never even seen before. And when I interviewed Hasselhoff, he said that a lot of it was improvised, especially the stuff with the personal trainer, which is the funniest stuff in the show. So, I mean, but that seems to be a thing. I didn't even know what the hell's the name of the Rob Schneider show.
The Rob Schneider show is Really Rob or Rob for Real. I reviewed it when it came out in the fall on Netflix. Basically, I reviewed it the week after Donnie exclamation point on USA, the Donnie Deutsch version of this exact same franchise,
right,
which is one of the worst things on TV last year. Just unbearable crap.
Yeah.
And by that standard, the Rob Schneider thing was not, you know, as bad.
Right.
It was absurdly cheap. Like, it was almost entirely self-funded. It was it co-stars his real-life wife, who I believe is also a co-creator on the show. It was all shot in wherever in Florida he really lives. But it's masquerading vaguely as Los Angeles, despite the fact that it looks absolutely nothing like Los Angeles. You know, the budget on this must have been 25 cents.
Yeah.
Whereas Dice is significantly higher production values, and they actually did shoot in Las Vegas for Las Vegas. And the other thing is, Andrew Dice Clay is a reasonably good actor of a certain type. And, you know, we've talked, I think, about how great he was in Vinyl, the Vinyl pilot.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's
yeah.
great there. Blue Jasmine, he's good. And here he's okay. It's perhaps after those roles a little bit disappointing to see him just playing himself and being all apologetic about how, oh, the Dice Man's just a persona. You're seeing Andrew now. He's different. But the second episode of the show, the one that's going to air this Sunday, it features Oscar winner Adrian Brody, and it is genuinely funny.
Okay.
So, like, I would tell people that if they're curious about Dice, watch the second episode and maybe just don't worry about the rest, because the second episode is actually really, really funny, and of the six episodes I've seen, it's the only one that's truly laugh-out-loud funny.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't crazy about the first one. I was actually back in his heyday. I was a big fan of Dice's. I still think that The Dice Man Cometh, his first HBO special, is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And I'm actually a very big fan of Ford Fairlane. And I am. I happen to be
Keep digging, man. Just keep digging.
I understand. I may as well admit it. I actually happen to be a huge fan of Rennie Harlan. And I still look forward to his movies. So that's how.
Okay, well, see, it's different parts of that were differently, because I mean, you know, you go back. I can point to a handful of Rennie Harlan movies that I can get behind, but I don't know when the last one I saw was.
Right. Well, Dice, though, it is on that same level. That I mean, I wonder why that's a. Dan, have you ever thought about why this is now a subgenre now that seems to be the go-to thing?
It's just self-absorption. I mean, there's nothing else to it, and it's self-absorption, and periodically it works. And so the fact that Curb Your Enthusiasm worked allows us to excuse the absurd number of these that don't work. And that's not just including the Donny Deutsch one and the Rob Schneider one. I mean, I still like to make jokes about the Paul Reiser show, which most people don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
It did. You know, there was the Comedians on FX last year with Josh Gad and Billy Crystal, which got canceled after one season. It was in this same vein.
Right.
I think that basically Curb Your Enthusiasm enabled a lot of people to think that this was either easy or had the potential to be great, as opposed to realize how great Larry David is and think that, you know, not believe that anything about it was transferable.
Right.
Other than Larry David is great.
You know, it's funny because that leads me to one of your tweets, which is that you tweeted this past week or so. I'll miss having to explain to people why I can't stand episodes. Which falls into that.
Are you going to ask me to explain to people?
Well, no, I'm just, it's, no, you don't have to. I'm just saying, you know, I think it ties into the genre of the conversation we're talking about.
It totally does. Yeah. And you know, the best thing about episodes by, you know, a million miles is Matt LeBlanc as Matt LeBlanc. And if the whole show were just Matt LeBlanc as Matt LeBlanc, I might like episodes, but it's an awful lot of things that aren't that. And so, as a result, I don't like it. But episodes will be coming to an end after whatever its upcoming season is.
Boy, it seems like it's been on for 15 years, man.
And every once in a while, it gets nominated for Emmys and Golden Globes and stuff. And you go, oh, right, they aired a season of that this year. Nice.
All right. HBO's got a big TV film, a film coming up, HBO movie, called Confirmation. And it's based on the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas situation from the early 90s. And it's Kerry Washington, of course, Bunk in it, which he would, of course, be Wendell Pierce. But I like to prefer I call all the actors from The Wire by their characters' names.
Oh, who does? There is no point whatsoever in saying that anybody other than the Bunk is playing Clarence Thomas.
Exactly.
Don't even bother.
All right, so Confirmation. I'm really curious about this, looking forward to it, and I am going to watch it. What'd you think?
It's okay. I think that there's always this wave of hype that hits HBO biopics because they get really good stars. and that often makes them enticing. But then there's also this other side of things where when a bad biopic comes out in the movies, everyone goes, oh, it's just an HBO biopic. And no one stops to think that those are two really contradictory ways of approaching things. Yeah. Because either an HBO biopic is something you get really excited about or something that you call a bad movie in the theaters. Right. And I've always been perplexed by that. And this is a slightly above average HBO biopic. Mm. It's not even a biopic. It's really just a week. It's the week of those hearings. And I think it's worth watching because I do think that, for example, Kerry Washington, I think is terrific. I think she is. And I think it's really intriguing how well cast she is because I think my perception of Anita Hill, for example, is I was surprised to see that Kerry Washington is older than Anita Hill was at those trials or hearings rather. And yeah. That was surprising. It's funny to see how well she inhabits that role, and it doesn't feel like a movie star, TV star, you know, looking frumpy to do a TV movie, which these things often do. She tweaks her voice just a little bit. She raises her voice. She changes her cadence. It's a good performance. The Bunk does not look very much like Clarence Thomas circa 1990, 1991. He is a larger man at this point, yeah. As is Clarence Thomas, of course, so he probably matches him better now. But I think they have some sort of similarities in their vocal tone, which become interesting when you get to famous moments like Clarence Thomas talking about high-tech lynching of an uppity black, et cetera.
Right.
But there are things that Wendell Pierce captures nicely there. There are a lot of places where it goes fuzzier than I wanted it to. I wanted it to take more of a stand on certain things that happened, certain sort of miscarriages of justice that went down associated with it. But on the other hand, that's sort of my knee-jerk, liberal, hippy-dippy, having dealt with 25 years of Clarence Thomas being on the Supreme Court kind of thing. So anyone who has different sensibilities is probably going to come away with different feelings towards the movie, I would guess.
Okay. All right. And that does that premiere on Sunday?
Either Saturday or Sunday. I think it might be Saturday. Sunday is the vinyl finale and the girls finale.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it. I happen to be a really big fan of Kerry Washington's, and I'll watch The Bunk do anything, which is
the supporting cast is fantastic as well. You know, you get Greg Kinnear doing his Joe Biden thing. That's a little funny. Jennifer Hudson pops up for, you know, like 5 minutes in a supporting role, and you go, oh, come on, it's Jennifer Hudson. She won an Oscar. Surely she should be in a more prominent role, but she's not. It's a good cast. There are some people. There are a lot of people who I would say probably are being wasted here, but it's still good to see them.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Jennifer Hudson, because Jennifer Hudson, as the Oscar winner, you're talking about how she's in this thing, and I haven't seen confirmation, but she's in it for a very short period of time. Was there any scenes in Chirac where she wasn't crying? Because, like, that's all she did in that movie, was she walked in and cried.
I think she was very talented.
And I do, too.
I think it's hard for people to envision what they should be casting her in. And, you know, part of that is Hollywood racism. Part of it is simply the fact that she's only still starting out as an actress. And so maybe it's hard to envision her in certain things because she hasn't acted all that much, and also she wants to have her career as a musician.
Yeah.
Of course, she's fantastic. And yeah. So I think she hasn't had breakout roles, and I kind of wonder at this point if she will, but I think she deserves more than 5 minutes in Confirmation.
Okay. All right. Now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, speaking of Jenner Hudson, it's the end of an era, Dan, and you wrote about American Idol, which I did not see one moment of this season. I want to talk about the impact that show made and the piece that you wrote about it. Okay, Dan, hang on.
Excellent.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, and he's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN, The Fine Print. All right, it's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, and we're going to take a break and be back. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN Triple Play Thursday coming up. Dan Feinberg is our guest. We always talk TV with Dan. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And before the break, we were talking about Jennifer Hudson starring, well, co-starring, or briefly, as Dan put it, in the HBO film Confirmation, and that will bring us to American Idol. Dan, American Idol ended, it started in 2002, but how many seasons did it actually have? Because they did the split season thing a couple times, correct?
No, they did not do any split season things. They did summer in the first year, and then they skipped fall and went to winter, and then it was just every winter.
Oh, got it.
That.
Okay.
There wasn't one of those. It wasn't a Voice or Survivor or Amazing Race thing, and then it wasn't like Big Brother where they had that one weird spring installment because of the writer's strike.
Right.
They kept Idol straightforward and every winter, and this year was the 15th and final, but really it's not going to be the final season of American Idol.
No, what is that for real now, or is it's going to come back?
It'll come back at some point. The question is sort of who's going to blink first and bring it back, whether it's going to be Fox in 5 years, whether it's going to be YouTube subscriber service in 3 years. I have no way of knowing who's going to want to bring American Idol back, but American Idol will come back at some point. It's still too big, and even in diminished capacity in recent years, the finale still drew nearly 13 million viewers. It still did a 3.0 in the only age demographic that Fox really cares about. And so those numbers were basically the best Fox has this side of Empire and the best almost any other network has anywhere. Mm. So, you know, yes, the bloom is off the rose and has been off the rose for years, but it's still a decent show. And given a little bit of time for absence to make the heart grow fonder, I think that it'll come back and probably people will be happy to have it back, particularly if, I don't know, if they bring back Simon or something. But, I think it'll be back.
Okay. All right. Well, how did you feel about this season? And then let's talk about the finale. How did you feel about the season in general?
I thought the season was probably not all that great. I thought that everything was rushed. They decided early on that they were going to get the show off the air by April, which had something to do with them not being sure how badly it was going to fall off, and ultimately it ended up doing well enough that probably they would have been just as happy to have it going for another couple weeks.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you know, that ship sailed. So everything was a little rushed. I felt like a lot of the best talent got voted out very early, which happens periodically, and American Idol's always had its weird voting patterns and all of that, and they ended up with a couple talented people, and you probably won't ever see albums by any of them. And that's been kind of the trend in recent years on Idol. You'd have to go back to Phillip Phillips a few years ago to have an Idol winner who actually sold albums and made any sort of impression in the marketplace.
Right.
I don't think this season's going to change that. But the finale was really a good reminder of just how many talented people really did come through American Idol over the years, because the answer is a ton.
So the finale was satisfying. Was it a good way to send off the show for however long it's going to be away?
I think it was, because it was just great to see so many of those people who, at various different times, I was invested in to different degrees. I ended up buying almost none of their albums, and that's okay. But, you know, most of the people came out and did their thing. Kelly Clarkson is really, really, really pregnant, so she recorded a little medley but didn't show up live, but she was live earlier in the season and actually gave the season its best moments by
what I heard, yeah.
No, I mean, that was a beautiful moment. And Kelly Clarkson's just, she really is ridiculously talented. Mm. And so all credit to her, and her moment where she cried and made all the judges cry and made Ryan sniffly. It was a beautiful moment. You know, no sarcasm or anything to that. And, you know, all the other people, for the most part, showed up at the finale. Carrie Underwood did her thing. Fantasia did her thing. Jennifer Hudson sang a bit. You know, just dozens of people. And passionate fans probably recognized all of them, because we spent a lot of time with these people. And some of them were really great, and some of them weren't. But I liked the finale because it showed how much ground Idol covered over its time, and there were always preconceptions about what the show was and who the artists were who came through it. But if you watched the finale, you saw that the answer to who was on American Idol over 15 seasons was singers of nearly every type, and some of them fantastic.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I actually watched, I believe, a little bit of the first, you know, round this season, and then it just, nothing really captured me. I was just kind of done with it. Now, but you said that the numbers, though, in the finale were really, really great. Were there consistent numbers? Did more people watch it than, let's say, last season because it was the final season?
There was a little bit of a bump, and at the points at which there wasn't a bump, there was at least a reversal of decline, I think. There was definitely, there were 3 or 4 years where the show was plummeting each week, and it was a big story. You know, what was Idol going to lose to this week? How embarrassing was it going to look that the show was going to keep limping along? And this season, it wasn't like that. This season, it wasn't huge, and it wasn't winning its slot every night like it did really for 11 or 12 years.
Yeah.
But it got a little bit of a bump, and probably more than the talent actually coming out week to week justified. So,
and say now, you know, you said earlier that The Voice is pretty much the only thing that NBC has going. I mean, are the numbers still astonishingly big for The Voice?
They're not astonishingly big. It's fallen off, and it still does fairly well. It does very, very well in the opening rounds. That is the part that people love about The Voice. They love the spinning chairs. They love the judges bickering over who's going to take individual singers. But then once the singers actually start performing and it starts getting toward the finale, for the most part, no one ever cares about The Voice.
Yeah.
And even fans of The Voice, for the most part, can only barely retain the winners. And if you look at the sales totals for the winners of The Voice, it's not even a drop in the Idol bucket. And yet the people love the judges. And it's just a different focus that the show has. Because
right.
the kids, as a rule, who appear on The Voice, they're less unrefined because they were chosen through a process where only good people were brought in first place. And so the show has always had a different kind of focus and a different thrust to it, as opposed to Idol, which was, let's take someone from off the farm in Kentucky who you've never, you know, even imagined could exist, and let's give them 15 weeks to go from being a talent show contestant to being a potential superstar.
Yeah.
The Voice has never done that.
All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is here. We got more to talk about. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here every morning. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and at 6 o'clock, Steve Cochran for your morning drive right here on WGN. You can get a hold of us by following us on Twitter, at Nick D Show, by calling us or texting us at 312-981-7200. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, so like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're going to continue our conversation with Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We love to talk TV with Dan. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So let's get to People versus O.J. Simpson, which, you know, this will be the last time we talk about it.
And there's no baskets to talk about anymore.
And no baskets to talk about. No, we talked about baskets finale last time, which is just amazing. But, yeah, the People versus O.J. Simpson, I got to say, Dan, I don't know if I've been as compelled by a show. I can't remember the last time I was compelled by a show so hypnotically and, like, addicted to it. I loved it, and I thought the finale was great. What do you make of the finale, Dan?
First of all, I feel like there's still at least one, possibly two seasons of Fargo that I need to get you to watch.
Oh, yeah. Okay, absolutely. Yes. I'm one season behind on Fargo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
And you got a while because there isn't going to be a new season in 2016. So
okay.
You can take your time.
Okay.
But I liked the finale a lot. I thought the finale captured this strange ambivalence and intermediary position between happiness and sadness and hollowness of that verdict. And, you know, that was where the story had to go because that's how reality was. And I thought that a lot of that was captured in the finale.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. And Sarah Paulson made me cry, damn it. she did. She made me cry. And, you know, it's the thing that I found interesting was that what was great about it was that they got to the verdict a half an hour into the episode. The episode was 90 minutes. And they got to the verdict a half an hour in, and then, like, there was all the stuff after the verdict that they covered, which I thought was a really great way to sum it up. So, it didn't end, you know, with the verdict because everybody knew the verdict. And so I thought that was really, really an interesting way of doing it.
And also the verdict would have actually been a climactic ending, and I don't think they wanted it to end on a climax. I don't think they wanted it to end on whatever the quote-unquote shocking moment was, whatever the, if you're pro-OJ, I don't know that now anyone's pro-OJ, but that's neither here nor there. If you wanted to celebrate with the OJ Dream Team, you know, they didn't want to end it there, and they didn't want to end it with point-blank the misery of the verdict for the prosecution. They wanted to end it with the, okay, what do we do now, and
exactly.
What does this actually mean, and what's to be accomplished by any of this?
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer to all of those questions was nothing, you know. This wasn't justice served. This wasn't vindication for OJ. There was no one who walked away from this going, okay, this was exactly what I wanted to have occur.
Yeah.
And that's a weird emotion for a TV series to end on.
Oh, absolutely. And I thought that the final, the final image of Cuba Gooding out in the backyard looking at the statue was a pretty brilliant image to end it on. And then it was kind of shocking at the end when they showed you, what are these people doing now and who's, obviously passed away and, where they are now. It was really shocking to see how closely each of the actors and actresses resembled the real people. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. I thought it was great. And this thing is going to, it's going to clean up at the, at the Emmys. Don't you think, Dan?
Oh, it's going to win so many Emmys. It's going to make everyone's head spin, and it's going to make me sad because it's going to take many episodes away from Fargo, which I still think is still, honestly, a much better production. And I prefer it on nearly every level. But I completely understand why People vs. OJ is going to win everything. So Sarah Paulson's going to win, who else? Courtney B. Vance is going to win. It's going to win for miniseries. It's going to win for writing. It's going to win for directing. It's going to win for casting. It's going to win for cinematography. Everything. And then we'll see if Travolta wins an Emmy for this.
Right.
Just make my brain explode. we'll see. Because if Travolta wins an Emmy for this, that means he's going to get an Emmy that Sterling K. Brown didn't guess.
Yeah.
And that'll just make me unhappy.
I understand. Okay. Now that ended, and also there was the season finale of The Walking Dead, which again is another show that I stopped watching. And then judging by my news feed last Sunday night, it pissed off a lot of people. And then I read about it because I don't care about spoilers. Well, we do here. I don't want to give anything away for anybody listening. But I personally don't care about spoilers when it comes to The Walking Dead. It doesn't bother me. You tweeted something out about The Walking Dead that you said, upon reflection, the ending of last night's Walking Dead essentially whacked the viewer for bothering to care. And that seems to be a resounding feeling that lots of folks felt.
Well, it ended on a cliffhanger, which is just one of those things. But it did end with a cliffhanger where the evil character, Negan, who we've been, we're teased about coming for his arrival for basically an entire year, and which I hear people cared about or they didn't, and I never cared. But he was played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who seems to be well cast and probably, might actually be good. And it really did end with him bashing the camera in the face with baseball, with a baseball bat named Lucille. And somebody will have gotten beaten by a baseball bat, but we can't actually spoil it because we don't know.
You don't know. And that was what everybody was angry about.
I wasn't even honestly that angry about it. I was more angry about the fact that the episode itself was a meandering
75 minutes of very, very little, and that the entire season really was this build-up to introducing a character who comic fans love, but who fans of the TV show had no reason to care about, and they never gave us a reason to care. And then he showed up and presumably bludgeoned someone we care about with a baseball bat, presumably. And so when it's the choice between villain I don't care about and character who I maybe care about, and I'm not even sure how many characters I care about on Walking Dead anymore, but yeah. I'm going to sympathize with the person I care about, and that person's going to be gone, whoever it is. And yeah, it was not good, and really most of this season was unsatisfactory, and it remains the highest rated show on TV.
I know, you know, and the thing about that, Dan, is the way you described this season finale about meandering and la la la. That's how I felt about the show two seasons ago when I gave up on it. I just got to the point. I gave up on it halfway into the season following the governor.
And I just put it on right now, and it would be essentially like you missed nothing.
Yeah.
You know, the people who you didn't recognize, probably fans of the show, barely remember their names. And the people who were on it when you watched it, except the ones that have been killed off, very little's happened to them that you'd care about.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not telling you should tune back in, because whatever.
Okay. All right. But, now, let me ask you, Dan, are you watching the 80s miniseries on CNN?
I'm not. Is it fun? I feel like I've missed them, but also, after 5 or 6 versions of I Love the 80s and other things like that, I feel like I've covered a lot of it, but it's just more gratifying.
It is. I like it very much. I've watched the 2 episodes, and I really enjoy it. I mean, I was, you know, in the 80s, I was in my teens and in my 20s in the 80s, so it's a time period that I remember fondly and had a good time. And I remember, obviously, a lot of the pop culture and clearly, you know, a lot of the news events and things. So I'm having a good time watching it. And I think they do enough of an interesting job and a varying coverage of what they're doing to make it different than the stuff that VH1 and other, you know, networks have done. I would give it a shot. I think it's actually really good.
CNN has done a pretty good job with the ones that they've done leading up to this. I feel like I watched some chunk of the 60s one that they did, and you know, if there weren't so darn much TV, I would get into that, but you know, there are so many things.
I understand.
Just more and more backed up every minute.
I understand. So let me ask you this. I watch my Seinfeld reruns pretty regularly on TBS, and I can't help but see tons of commercials for this show, The Detour. And you have actually seen it. How many episodes of The Detour have you seen, this new sitcom that's on TBS?
7 episodes. It's created by Jason Jones and Samantha Bee. Samantha Bee is having quite the spring, because Full Frontal with Samantha Bee is fantastic, and everybody should be watching it, particularly mm-hmm. people who miss kind of the anger of what The Daily Show was before Trevor Noah, who I also like for the record, but he's not angry in the same way Jon Stewart was. Samantha Bee's angry in some of the same ways. But, Detour is basically, it's like the vacation movies, only as a TV series. And it's kind of rough, and it runs the gamut between really, really broad humor. You know, there's one episode that's bookended with explosive diarrhea and vomiting, and, you know, some people find that very funny and other people less so.
Yeah.
But I laughed at it a fair amount. In the 7 episodes I saw, there was enough in just about every episode that I laughed at that I will continue watching it once I catch up with what's aired. It's funny. It's not all the way there, but it's already been renewed for a 2nd season, and I think the people involved with the show are talented enough that there's a lot of upside to it if they continue along the road they're on.
All right. Okay, so that's on TBS, and that's The Detour. All right, listen, Dan, always a pleasure to talk to you, man, and we'll have a lot to talk about in a couple of weeks when you come back. People can read you at the Hollywood Reporter, and check you out on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN, The Fine Print. As always, a real pleasure, Dan. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
My pleasure, Nick. Talk to you later.
Take care. There you go. There's Dan Feinberg. Again, check him out at The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN, The Fine Print.